Was this some crazed fan out to stab me like George Harrison? Eventually, she got to me and handed me the bag, wordlessly. I was thinking, why did this traveling saleswoman just hand me her breakfast? She read the look on my face and said simply, Grubhub. It turns out Natalia had ordered breakfast chicken bites, which I didn't even know existed, never mind that they were an item that a portly teen could schlep to your door. In retrospect, I think it started with Taco Bell delivery. I wrote not Taco Bell material, but I have a lot of Taco Bell material. They will not rest until our livers explode. First, they invented the fourth meal. Then they got a soft taco to rape a hard shell taco and called it a gordita. Then they covered all the tacos in Dorito dust. And finally, they started driving it to your house. You can't drive or walk one block to Taco Bell, and nothing is a better value weight-wise. You spend $4.85, and you'll hyperextend your elbow carrying the bag out. I think Mexico has been trying to reclaim the Southwest through ranchero music, blaring that horrible crap so we'll all eventually say, fuck it, I'm moving to Connecticut. My kid has to study for an algebra final, and all I can hear is tuba and the accordion. Now, I'm thinking Taco Bell is in on it, fattening us up so we can't fight back. They will not rest until we do nothing but rest. Then there was the time I went out with Lynette for our 16th anniversary. We left Natalia and Sonny by themselves. Olga, the nanny, was out of town. God forbid they make themselves a meal. So we allowed them to have some friends over and order from Postmates. I came home to find a large cheese pizza with two slices taken out. But the cheese from those two slices was piled on the side of the cardboard box. I immediately started thinking of ways to bring the pizza into the office and force my employees to eat it. Unlike my kids and their friends, I can't let that go to waste. I'm now at the point where I'm considering raising a pig in the back of the house. There's so much wasted food at my abode, I just need a slop trough and a hog to eat this shit. It occurred to me recently that bad pizza smells better than good pizza. It tastes like cardboard and has the texture of Nerf, but the thick, doughy garbage from the concession stand at the auto show or the ballpark, even the rectangular pizza from school that tastes like a yoga mat covered in ragu, smells better than the good, thin-crust New York style. I guess it's overcompensation. After my pizza cheese outrage subsided, I found myself in Sonny's room where I noticed a bag from Shake Shack. The kids had ordered from two different places. Two different delivery people had darkened my doorstep with two different orders from two different restaurants. When I was growing up, if you had suggested to my father that we could go out to two different restaurants in one night, never mind having two different restaurants deliver, he would react the same as if you waved a log on fire in front of a Cro-Magnon man. He would have just grunted in fear and confusion. On that note, I was driving around L.A. recently and saw a sign at Jack in the Box, which for those of you not in the region, is a poor man's McDonald's. It read, "We accept EBT." If you don't know what that stands for, congratulations, winner. It's Electronic Benefit Transfer, formerly known as food stamps. I know I'm an angry rich guy, but it's fucking infuriating that our government allows tax money to be put on a card so poor people can kill themselves with shitty food. In my opinion, if that ain't your money, you shouldn't get that crap. I want you eating good meat, eggs, cheese, and produce. Who's paying for the diabetes you'll be getting from this culinary abortion? As a former food stamp kid who grew up on welfare, desperate for a decent meal, I'm driven insane by this. We have lost the sense of food's value in this culture, but not all of us. I recently saw Olga the nanny pulling every piece of gristle, tendon, and fat off the chicken bones from one of our dinners and putting it in a Ziploc bag for Phil. She gets the value of food. The Native Americans used every piece of the buffalo because Grubhub didn't exist. None of those Indians sat in their teepee and waited for Flapdash to bring the buffalo. They had to go on a 100-mile, 3-day odyssey, from which some of them didn't return, in order to get that buffalo. So they were going to use every fucking part of it. It's like the Kardashians. They film every part of their lives and turn it into something. My kids don't eat every part of their burger from Shake Shack because a loser delivered it, so it has no value. I'm not immune to this. I have a steam shower in my house. It's all tile. Well, I didn't want to sit on the 90-degree tile because that would be like sitting on a curb in the summer. I was looking for something better than just a folded towel, something that could take the heat and the damp without falling apart. So I made my assistant look for it for weeks. It was a 2-month saga of follow-ups with Matt trying to find the right steam shower ass coaster. One day I just said, type in steam room pillow and see what comes up. He found one that was antimicrobial, had adequate cushioning for the ace man's ass, and looked good. We ordered it, and I waited anxiously. I followed up a couple of days later to get a status update. Matt told me, Amazon is going to deliver it today. I was very excited about my steam room butt pillow. All day I kept looking at the front door, pacing feverishly, ready to put it to use. I was like a kid on Christmas, except that kid was Jewish and there were no gifts coming. No package was delivered. I announced to the heavens that this was a disaster. And of course, this is what happens to me. Could it go any other way? As I was heading out to do stand-up, dejected, the Amazon guy pulled up, walked about 15 feet up the driveway, and dropped the package. I was outraged. I had been fantasizing all day about sitting on the pillow in my steam room. But this asshole delivered it late, right as I was driving away. So I had to wait until the next day for my asshole to enjoy it. Bullshit. It then hit me that I hadn't ordered it from Amazon. I had told my assistant to order it from Amazon. I hadn't even overcome the lethargy to Google it myself and enter my credit card number. I'd had Matt do it. And I was angry that the delivery guy hadn't walked into the front door of my $7 million house with a steeply graded driveway. Did this guy expect me to walk 15 feet on my own property? Downhill? This wasn't medication for my diabetic infant. This was so my rich white ass didn't have to sit on a towel. This is fall of the Roman Empire shit. Add in the copious amounts of pornography I consume, and I'm an ostrich feather fan and a virgin feeding me peeled grapes away from going full Caligula. The other day I had the sad realization about how lazy we'd gotten when I was talking to Lynette about our Roomba robot vacuum. I noticed it was not being used and asked her why. She said because you have to charge it in its little doghouse and clean out the dustbin once a month. I said, are you telling me we're too lazy to own a robot? We're going to convenience ourselves out of existence. We need to rein this in quickly before we end up like the fat asses hovering around in chairs in WALL-E. The ball has been snapped and the play is on. We have to do this on the fly. Eventually, we'll be calling Lyft to say, I'm on the toilet and I really need to get to the sofa. Master of the universe. There's only one way out of this, and it's not going to be something we can buy and have delivered. It comes from within. We're going to need to learn to master ourselves. Now, I had a head start on learning how to deprive myself and subjecting my body to extremes. As readers of Not Taco Bell material know, I lived in an uninsulated service porch that identified as my bedroom. When I lived in my dad's A-frame house, I was at the top of the A in an unventilated attic. Every summer night, my sleep would be like a Bikram yoga class. The only thing emptier than the attic was our fridge. With convenience being so convenient nowadays, we're going to have to force ourselves into circumstances that mirror those of our caveman ancestors, which, if you judge by the hair on my ass, was probably only 2 generations ago. One of the simplest to understand, but hardest to achieve ways of challenging yourself is NSNG. No sugar, no grain for the uninitiated. I'm not going to get into the weeds on NSNG. This isn't a celebrity diet book. There are plenty of those on the market. You can Google my friend and frequent podcast guest, Vinny Tortorich, to find out all about it. But the title should be self-explanatory. Turns out that while we were being fed stuff that was killing us, we're also being fed a line of bullshit. That line goes all the way back to the founding of the Kellogg Company, progressed all the way through the Snackwell era of the 80s, and the USDA food pyramid in 1992, and is going strong today with the Impossible Burger craze. It says grain is good and meat is murder. Grains and bread are literally the foundation of the U.S. government's food pyramid. Meat is the second smallest section near the top, and fats are at the pinnacle, along with sweets. Fat makes for a perfect enemy. It has the word fat right in the name. Fat will make you fat. Turns out that idea is as true as the old notion that being out in the cold will give you a cold. The government has the food pyramid completely upside down. Much like many other bullshit ideas hatched by the government and forced down the throat of every school kid. I know hundreds of people who have rapidly lost weight and increased energy, including myself, doing NSNG. That's the side benefit. But my point is larger than that. Sugar's addictive, and it's hard to break that habit. And that's why it's important. The real win with NSNG is that you're fighting that inner child who's hooked on sugar smacks. You're facing your infantile cravings and punishing yourself a little to achieve greater health. We need to get away from what I call the yummy phase. We all know people who are stuck in a childlike mentality and would eat macaroni and cheese for every meal. Maybe you're one of them. Take this quick test to see if you're stuck in the yummy phase. Yummy phase test. Pick one from each category below. Starbucks order. 1, black coffee. 2, coffee with cream. 3, coffee with cream and sugar. 4, flavored coffee, vanilla, hazelnut, mocha, etc. 5, some blended frappuccino thing with whipped cream and a dome lid. Alcoholic drink. 1, gin martini. 2, scotch on the rocks. 3, beer or red wine. 4, white wine. 5, daiquiri, pina colada, or other blended fruity drink. Steak. 1, rare. 2, medium rare. 3, medium. 4, well done. 5, well done with ketchup. Side dish. 1, asparagus. 2, cream spinach. 3, baked potato. 4, mashed potato. 5, macaroni and cheese. Seafood. 1, sashimi. 2, broiled salmon. 3, shrimp cocktail. 4, breaded calamari. 5, fish and chips. After the meal. 1, cigar. 2, brandy. 3, cheese plate. 4, pie. 5, cake and ice cream. Sports. 1, UFC. 2, boxing. 3, football. 4, baseball. 5, soccer. Eating pussy and or sucking cock. 1, I'm doing it now. Two, every time we make love. 3, on our anniversary. 4, only when I'm really drunk. 5, I'm going to vomit in my mouth. Add the total of your chosen numbers. Scoring guide. The higher the number, the yummier you are. 0 to 8, you're my hero. 9 to 16, we could definitely hang out. 17 to 24, congratulations, you're an adult. 25 to 32, you're a child. 33 to 40, you're a special needs child. The message translates beyond the taste buds. This is about learning to appreciate that which doesn't immediately give you pleasure. Why has the price of everything except food inflated? The price of your house has gone up. The price of your car has gone up. But pizza, or a taco from Taco Bell, is still as cheap as it was when I got rejected from working there. Because it's trash. Full of sugar, artificial flavors, preservatives, and additives. But we keep going back to it. Or rather, we keep having it delivered to our lazy, ever-widening asses. The corporations producing this slop know they have us hooked and are tapping into something primitive and immature. The need for immediate gratification and to avoid pain. Punishing yourself a little is a good thing. And in today's society, it's fucking necessary. You need to murder your inner child. Perhaps you should drown it in a pool, like I did. Here's another example from my own life. I live in the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains in an area called La Cañada. It's a little bit like Mayberry. You wouldn't even know you're minutes from the homeless-filled hellhole known as Los Angeles. Being in the hills, it can get colder at night than other parts of Southern California. This is where the self-inflicted discomfort comes in. For about 4 months out of the year, my pool can get into the 40 to 50 degree range. For over 3 years, I've been dunking myself in that pool daily, sometimes before dawn, naked. It's stimulating. The number one response people give me when I tell them to do this is, "But it's cold. I don't want to do that." Exactly. The answer is in the answer. You don't want to do that, but you should. When you get out of that freezing pool, you are completely woke, and not bullshit Brooklyn hipster woke. It stops you from sleepwalking around all morning in a bathrobe, followed by an afternoon crash. You'll tingle all day. You put yourself in harm's way intentionally and get the benefit of pushing past your comfort zone. If you have the means, I highly recommend it. If not, do what I do in the summer. Take a nice icy shower. I'll leave it to the scientists to tell you the health benefits of this. All I know is you'll never feel more alive. I'm not into cleanses or fasting, but I appreciate those ideas. I don't buy the bullshit about removing toxins, but I love the part about putting yourself in check and punishing yourself, though everyone I've ever met on a cleanse is a douche. The first toxin that comes out of your ass in liquid form is apparently your sense of humor. The key to all of this, whether it's NSNG, the cold pool dunk, fasting, hot yoga, walking on hot coals, running a marathon, or doing a tough mudder, is that you have to inflict it on yourself. You don't feel like you got a good workout if you run from a bear. Leonardo DiCaprio's character in The Revenant didn't feel like he got a workout. He was just surviving. If you run through the woods without being chased, you get something out of it. It has to be chosen. This is the next step in evolution, being able to control yourself. I don't care if my kids get college degrees. But if they can look at a piece of pecan pie and say, "Nay, I've done my job." With that self-discipline, you can turn mountains into speed bumps, and then life is yours. Use your hands or lose your mind. In movies, we have apocalyptic visions of machines turning on us. The Terminator, Maximum Overdrive, 2001, A Space Odyssey. But in real life, it won't be a robot with a machine gun in its hand killing you. It will be the robot in your hand. We're not all emergency neurosurgeons. We don't need to be reachable at all times. It's narcissism, and it's killing us. Every Sunday when I was a lad, I'd see the neighborhood dads and their kids out in the sun washing their cars. It was common. I'd see the stream of water running down the street from where Mr. Johnson was up the block washing his Buick. I haven't seen that in a long time. I live in LA where everyone is a piece of shit, but I think this is common across the country. There used to be a quiet dignity in, "I'll wash it myself," that we've lost. It takes time. You have to prepare the bucket of soapy water, get that sponge glove, give the car the once over twice, and then hose it down. Now, if you said you were going to wash your own car, your friend would say, "Don't be a sucker. Take it to the corner and give a Mexican $7 to wash it. You don't have time. You can afford it." Yes, but you can't afford not to do it. This mentality is especially killing males because the disconnect from the tangible world and immersion in the virtual world has made them unable to apply logic. Dawson, I'm going to go on a little free jag here for a second. As we record this, we're right in the middle of this lockdown pandemic, and something that's come to my mind is why we don't have the proper relationship with danger. What is real danger? What is made up danger? What is invisible danger? And it struck me that we used to have a great relationship with danger because every day we had to renew our vows. We had to have that relationship with danger. If you have a job where you work with a chainsaw, every single day you have to re-up with danger, recalibrate with danger. When you have an invisible job where you just go to a cubicle and stare at a screen all day and then watch CNN, you lose your relationship with danger. Every guy who works with me, who works on the side of the building that works with blades and saws and tools and cutting wheels and acetylene rigs and fire, all those guys, punch presses, every single day, they calibrate. If they don't calibrate, they lose a hand, they lose a finger, they'll get their hair caught in a drill press, and it'll pull your scalp off. Anyone listening, have you guys fired up like a big bandsaw with a big like 4-inch blade on it? It's hairy. It's scary. You have to calibrate all the time. If you pick up a big like 3-horsepower plunge router and fire that thing up like that thing just with a 1/2-inch chuck and a carbide tip blade on it, that thing's a monster. Like it'll hurt you badly. You'll feel the torque in your hands. And speaking of torque, if you fire up one of those big impact guns with like 600 foot-pounds of torque to take that big center lock off the hub to remove the rim of a race car, that thing will break your forearm if you don't have the right relationship with it and you don't prepare for it. So all those guys do is live in that world. And for the people who live in that world, for the loggers and the truckers and the carpenters and the high-rise steel guys, that's their world. When something like this pandemic comes down the pike, they then assess it through the eyes of someone who has a relationship with danger. And then they think to themselves, well, how old am I? I'm 41. Okay, am I morbidly obese? No. Do I have pre-existing conditions? No. What about my kids? Well, it doesn't seem to affect them. Okay, I'm assessing my relationship with danger. Now, all the people, and there's more and more of these people, who have taken to the cubicles of life, all they do is light their fucking underwear on fire and run around in a circle because they don't have a relationship with it. They can't figure it out. And the news people are the furthest away from the relationship with danger, and they make more money if we can get more people to light their fucking underwear on fire. So they just spout that out. Then all the dumb people, and I don't mean dumb because they have college degrees on plaques on the wall behind them where they're panicking in their office. They're literally sitting in an office panicking with duct tape and towels pushed under the door so germs don't float under it. And behind them is a whole bunch of degrees from prestigious universities. Those people panic the most, not because they're dumb. They're book smart. They're danger dumb. They're danger dumb. They don't have a relationship with tools, the world. How about just getting on a horse that may be a little temperamental? When's the last time you did that? All the things we used to have to do, you think about what a logger has to do. You think about what a guy out there in the forest with a chainsaw or an axe has to do when he's cutting down a tree. He's got to figure out a whole bunch of shit. Otherwise, he's going to be crushed. He's not going to make it to Tuesday of the first week. Or how about the guy who loads up that big flatbed truck with all the logs and then lashes them down and then heads down the mountain road? You don't think those guys are well-versed in danger? And then tell me how scared those guys are of the next pandemic or this pandemic or the killer bees coming from Africa or AIDS being a equal opportunity killer or secondhand smoke causing 50,000 Americans to die every year. You tell me, because they're not. Because they have a relationship. You guys who may be in your cubicle need to go out to the garage and reacquaint yourself with tools so you can reacquaint yourself with danger. And once you calibrate yourself, then you're in a much better position. And don't tell me this condescending bullshit. When the people who who are cowering in their offices right now with all the fucking degrees and awards behind them for their academic excellence. They would say, oh, well, the guys in my shop that are operating a cutting wheel, operating a carborundum blade right now with sparks shooting out of it all over the place, they would condescendingly say, those guys aren't smart enough to know what's really going on. That's condescending bullshit. They know how to work. They know how to assess danger. Every time you build a scaffolding and have to climb up to the top of it to put stucco up on the top of the third floor of the apartment building you guys are building, that's an assessment with danger. They have worked it out. You guys haven't. So please recalibrate. Thanks, Allison.
You know, you make a great point, because if you have zero relationship with danger, you can't adequately calibrate what real danger is.
Right.
Makes perfect sense.
Daniel Kellison can't calibrate for danger. He doesn't never picked up a weed whacker. He doesn't know what it is. That's right. Adult men are struggling with reason, and I think technology is the problem. When every action is virtual, so are the consequences. Take my old field, construction. It's a logic and reason puzzle. You need to do things sequentially, to measure twice and cut once, or there are consequences, potentially deadly ones. Guys who work on offshore oil derricks need to have more logic and reason than people who work in tech. Because if the offshore guy fucks up, they'll get hit with a pipe and fall into the ocean. We need to do more with our physical bodies in order to challenge our brains. It used to be part of life. You needed to figure out how to dig a well, or you wouldn't survive. We used to have mines. Now we have Minecraft. We used to have farms. Now we have Farmville. We used to fight wars. Now we have Clash of Clans. We used to dodge actual barrels thrown by an ape. Now we have Donkey Kong. Okay, I took that one a step too far. My point is that when we stopped chopping wood and carrying water, we invented a gym to make up the deficit. We stopped needing to row, so we invented rowing machines. We stopped walking and started driving, so we invented treadmills. We figured out pretty quickly on the physical end that we're going to need to burn some calories. We need to do the same thing with the other part of our bodies that's atrophying, our brains. You notice yourself getting fat, but you don't notice yourself getting dumb and disconnected, irritable, and unsatisfied. Lack of gratitude and the inability to delay gratification sneak up on you. Before you know it, you've got the society I've spent this book complaining about. We're going to need to make mental conditioning a part of our life's rituals, just as we've done with the physical conditioning. The problem is, you can sell a Bowflex, a Peloton bike, or a SoulCycle class, but there's no industry for take a hike through the forest while listening to Mozart. No one can sell you, go down to the beach and throw frisbee to your kid in the surf. And there's certainly no money to be made on things that are difficult. We're going to have to foist those upon ourselves. I say we're going to have to go full Amish. You know how the Amish have Rumspringa? When the teens get to drink, cavort, and generally do crazy shit like using light switches. We need to do the opposite of this. When all of us who are stuck in a virtual world go and do some old-fashioned barn raising for a few weeks. You never saw anyone with a long beard named Hezekiah saying he had a bad back from churning butter or whining on Yelp that his food took an extra 5 minutes to arrive because the horse pulling the carriage to deliver it threw a shoe. The future of the species. Homos and sapiens. So where are we headed? We've always talked about the shrinking middle class. There's another class that is shrinking, average dudes. In the future, all we're going to have are super puss and extreme dude. The haves and the have-nots will be those who have genitalia and those who don't. I believe strongly that mixed martial arts is the fastest growing sport because we're all in air-conditioned cars and ergonomically designed chairs. This disconnection from the real hard world that our forebears contended with is going to turn us into soft, gooey people. it's a fucking law of physics that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The pendulum could swing back the other way on all of this. I see it happening already, and it gives me some hope. Commercials are starting to go in divergent directions. For every one of the aforementioned commercials featuring puppies and cars made with love, I see an ad for a UFC pay-per-view. A select few heroes are pushing back against the softening trend and going to extremes, jumping off glaciers, doing Spartan challenges, getting into the octagon. I'm starting to have a lot of conversations with young men about what the fuck is wrong with other young men. I recently had a talk with a young employee who lamented that the rest of his coworkers were such lazy, thin-skinned, entitled shits. I agreed, but I told him that the good news was that all he had to do is be willing to show up to work and deal effectively with criticism, and he would be a model employee. The basics of yesteryear would make him an all-star. In the land of the lazy, the competent will be king. Things are starting to turn. It feels like when you're hungover and you've just had your first good puke. You're starting to feel a little relief. You know it's not over yet, but it's the beginning of the end. If the toughness trend continues, but doesn't make the shitty course we're on tap out, I fear that we'll end up evolving into two very different species. There will be a species called Homo octogonus and another called Homo sapiensis. Homo octogonus will literally have thick skin, like leather or burlap. They will have evolved from people who challenged themselves to be better instead of blaming others, who fasted and dove into cold pools, who when insulted, punched people at a bar instead of calling HR. Their entire body will be covered with calluses. They'll turn on whichever viewing device is invented in their time and hear, "Welcome to the Bukkake Cage Fighting Network." There are many other channels devoted to bukkake and cage fighting, but we were the first. Homo sapiensis will live in a dwelling made entirely of Nerf and bubble wrap because millennia of oversensitivity left them literally with thin skin. That super sensitive skin on your belly will cover their entire body. It will be as thin as seaweed that wraps sushi rolls and will be transparent, showing their organs. Of course, they'll have no sex organs. Having an identifiable gender would be an attack. They will have no teeth because centuries of yummy phase-based diet will have rendered them useless. When they turn on the TV, they'll hear, "Welcome to MSNBC LGBTQ. Tonight, is your veggie wash racist?" The opposite of dogs who can hear a wider range of frequencies, they'll be deaf to everything except for that with which they agree. The good news is that, like Neanderthals, the species will eventually die out because in their never-ending hunting and gathering of insults to confirm their victim status, they'll turn on one another in a slow civil genocide of microaggressions. The death of death. I would love to think that this grim look into the future won't matter because I won't be around to see it. But that might not actually be the case, given the rise of celebrity holograms. Shortly after Tupac made his holographic comeback playing Coachella, Amy Winehouse, Roy Orbison, Frank Zappa, Michael Jackson, Billie Holiday, and Whitney Houston all rose from the dead and went on tour. At least their greedy fucking families did. Even the Gipper, Ronald Reagan, is now back welcoming you to his library in Simi Valley. I would love to go there and shout, "Look out! There's a hologram of John Hinckley!" The families are trying to make a couple of bucks, trampling on the memories of their talented relatives. Last year, the family of James Dean said they would allow his image to be used to create a wholly digital character in a new movie. This is scary. My kids would definitely be like, "Yes, before our dad died, he expressed an interest in doing gay porn. How much did you say you pay the estate again?" Our dark and disgusting future will be one in which we never have to mourn anybody, because everyone will be alive in hologram form. As an atheist who believes life is short and that we should make the best of it while we can, I hate this idea. Life is not supposed to go on forever. It's supposed to be fleeting and therefore embraced. That said, after he passes, I'll strongly get behind the idea of holla, Graham Parker. Since I'm on the topic of death, how about the last words for this book? There will be no trigger warnings in this final chapter because I want to get away from that shit. I hope we stop being triggered in general. Being triggered robs you of your life. Freeform sidebar here for a second, Dawson. I had a conversation with Mike August a few days ago on the phone where we were talking about bullying, and he said, I don't think I've ever been bullied. And I said, I don't think I've ever been bullied either. And he said, I have had guys punch me in the face. And I go, yeah, I've had guys dump buckets of urine on my head and smash shit in my ear. And had a flaming marshmallow smash the side of my face once. And then my buddy Ray threw a knife and stuck in my knee. I have been pantsed on the girls' softball field and had them burn my underwear. But I don't feel like I've been bullied. And he said, yeah, me neither. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. We can check all the bullying boxes. I've been physically assaulted by a lot of people a lot of the time and had horrible things said to me many times by many people. I mean, my construction foremen were horrible guys who would say horrible things to you and threaten you. And I've had that with friends and classmates, but I never felt like I was bullied. And Mike said, yeah, me neither. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Maybe this is a state of mind. If you were to break down bullying, what was physically done to me between the ages of 13 and 27 would definitely fall under the heading of bullying. And I mean big time bullying that would border on criminal physical assault and battery. But I never felt bullied. So if you feel bullied because, somebody shout something at you from inside their moving car who you've never met before, or puts their hand on your shoulder and tries to slow your roll, then that's up to you. You don't have to be bullied. You never have to be bullied. If you think about it, it's bullied is in the eye of the bully holder. You can decide whether you've ever been bullied or not. And as a matter of fact, when I talk to people that say they were bullied in high school, I remember talking to a gal once about this, and I said to her, tell me the worst thing that happened. You were bullied all through high school. It was horrible. Tell me the worst thing that happened. And she said, one time I was walking home and these other mean girls followed me in their car. I was terrified. They followed me to my house. I said, and then what happened? And she said, no, that was it. And I said, but what happened when they got out of the car? And she said, no, they never got out of the car. They just followed me. And I thought, wow, are you choosing to be bullied? During school hours, I had a pile of human shit smashed into my left ear from a guy who could bench press 325 pounds, and I never felt bullied. I just felt like I had to get him back. Mike is the perfect candidate for never being bullied. Right? He has no idea if he's ever been bullied.
Perfectly aloof. He wouldn't know if he had been, I think.
Doesn't count people getting into a fist fight with him in the ninth grade as being bullied. That's what I love. Think about when you're in traffic and someone cuts you off. If you count to 10 Mississippi instead of immediately flipping the guy off and honking your horn, that anger will probably subside. You don't need half a day or even 15 minutes to call a therapist. One verse of the song you're listening to on the radio is enough time for the microstorm in your soul to pass. Cue Kane's flute music from Kung Fu and dig this metaphor on being triggered. Imagine that a fly lands on your nose. If you can wait 5 seconds before swatting at it, the fly will be gone. It will just fly away. If you take a whack at it, you'll just end up hitting your nose. So live your life like you're holding two pies. That way, if that same fly lands on your nose, you can't swat at it. Because if you do, you won't get the fly, you'll get the pie. The undercurrent of all my beefs in this book is fear. That's the bottom line of this shitty era we live in. Fear. You can tell because the culture doth protest too much, methinks. Every era has a buzzword or two. If you go back to the 50s, it was all rocket, jet, and atomic. A kid would buy a baseball mitt, it would be the rocket glove. His little red wagon would be jet-powered. In the 60s, everything was space age. The tinfoil that people had been using for decades was now a space age alloy. The space age thing hung on a little into the 70s, with the moon landing being in 1969. But in the later 70s, everything slowed down when we were told to keep on trucking. And we're saying 10-4 to their good buddies in the convoy during the CB radio craze. In the 1980s, we got back up to speed with turbo. Everything was turbocharged. And not just in your car. Your vacuum, your cologne, your laxative, all turbocharged. In the 90s, after the stealth bomber debuted, or did it? Everything was either stealth or mock. The razor in your medicine cabinet was stealth, and so was the vibrator underneath your bed. That vibrator was going to give you an orgasm before you knew what was coming. Literally. Dodge had a car called the Stealth. It was a piece of shit, but it was stealth. In the 2000s, with the advent of the X Games, everything was extreme. Or rather, extreme with a capital X. Everything from Mountain Dew to H&R Block's home accounting software was extreme. Brave is the buzzword for this era. This is obviously pushback against the idea that we know we've gone full-blown puss. The other version of this idea I see everywhere is fearless. I saw a magazine cover featuring Chrissy Teigen with the headline, Food, Family, and Being Fearless. Yeah, talking shit about Trump on Twitter and making scones with brown bananas. Fearless. You know who was truly fearless and brave? Jimmy Doolittle. For those of you who think I'm speaking about the doctor who could talk to animals, Google it, and then kill yourself. Our Navy had been decimated by the Japs during the attack on Pearl Harbor. He decided we needed to strike back. We weren't geared up for a strategic victory, but we needed a moral victory. We were going to get an aircraft carrier as close to Tokyo as possible, fly B-25 Mitchell medium bombers, and do a run knowing that we didn't have enough fuel to get back. This was a suicide mission, and Doolittle volunteered to lead it. That's fearless. Anyone who listens to my podcast knows I'm a big fan of the Albert Brooks movie, Defending Your Life. There are movies that make you laugh, like Tropic Thunder. There are movies that make you cry, like Brian's Song. And there are movies that make you think, like Crimes and Misdemeanors. This is one movie that does all three, along, of course, with the 1986 Stallone masterpiece, Cobra. My next book will be a Malcolm Gladwell-esque 300-page breakdown of that movie, nay, film. I would call Defending Your Life an important movie. In short, an advertising executive, played by Brooks, dies in a car accident and wakes up in an afterlife where he must prove in a court-like setting that he's successfully conquered fear while existing as a human on Earth. If he succeeds, he will go onward. If not, he'll be sent back to Earth to inhabit a new persona and try again. In the movie, the recently deceased Earthlings are called Little Brains by the residents of Judgment City because they only use 3-5% of their brains, and that 3-5% is consumed by fear. It's funny because it's true. This is what makes Brooks' movie brilliant. The more your life is focused on dealing with fear, the dumber you are. The news media and politicians and true crime show producers are trying to scare you into giving them your money and, in the case of social media, your attention and personal information. The more susceptible you are to that fear, the dumber you are, and the more of your life you're wasting. Albert Brooks' character, Daniel, has an attorney named Bob Diamond, played perfectly by Rip Torn. He tells Daniel the following about life on Earth.
Fear is like a giant fog. It sits on your brain and blocks everything. Real feelings, true happiness, real joy. They can't get through that fog. But you lift it, and buddy, you're in for the ride of your life.
I'm not telling you to liquidate your house and kids' college fund to open a business offering zip line tours, tours of the rainforest canopy. That may not work out. And I'm not telling you to take a stroll through bear country, chomping on beef jerky, wearing Beats by Dre headphones. You're going to get eaten. Being fearless doesn't mean putting yourself in danger. Evel Knievel was fearless, but he was also in traction half his life. Being fearless is not about not feeling fear. It's about mitigating fear. The happiest and the calmest guys I've ever met are IndyCar and mixed martial arts guys. If you're attracted to those two activities, you have already learned to master your fear. But the Indy guy wouldn't want to get in the octagon, and the MMA guy wouldn't want to get behind the wheel of an Indy car. They understand their strengths and weaknesses and what their passions are, and haven't let their fears hold them back from achieving greatness in their chosen fields. That's fearless. That's brave. It's about weighing a risk and embarking on a venture despite that risk. Taking that leap of faith that you might not succeed, but God damn it, you're going to try. We've been trained to be triggered by the mass media and Madison Avenue, by professors and politicians. We've been trained to live as if we're victims, that our power resides outside of ourselves in the form of our support animals or in the group that we've identified ourselves as a part of. Even if that group is just a bunch of people using the same hashtag. This book isn't about how the shit show our society has become is inconveniencing me. It's about, ironically, given the last few paragraphs, my fear that we won't be able to turn the ship around and that we won't have a society left for me to complain about. I've talked a ton of shit about a lot of people and about society in this book. If you're triggered by it, if you felt like I was victim blaming, if you felt like you deserve an apology, if you felt like creating an anti-Adam hashtag or going to a safe space with your emotional support animal, then clearly you weren't reading closely enough. I wasn't yelling at you. I was yelling for you. Epilogue. Coronavirus, panic, and pandemic. This book was done. It was edited, proofread, and designed. I was recording the audiobook. 2 days before it went to the printer, the COVID-19 virus brought the United States to a complete standstill. Whenever this book gets in your hands, which will have been washed 278,000 times, meaning you have sung happy birthday 556,000 times, or the equivalent of 3 fish songs. Who knows what the fuck will be going on? All of our social distancing and business shuttering may have kept the virus at bay and will have flattened the curve. And as a man who likes busty chicks, I hate the idea of flattening any curves. Or could be worse than predicted, and we could be living in underground caverns like the mole people. A movie written by my step-grandfather, Laszlo Gorog. Google it. So at the time of this writing, these are my thoughts. They may prove to be prescient or insane. But no matter what happens, when the infected dust settles, this virus will have brought out the worst, but hopefully some of the best, of the fucked up culture I just spent 200 pages trashing. There was opportunity in this crisis. It happened, we were powerless, and we had to make the most of it. In prison, there's a saying, you can do the time, or the time can do you. I learned that when I was doing 17 months for soliciting a This lockdown is like a short prison sentence. If you let the time do you, you're going to end up with a face tattoo and a toilet full of Pruno. Or if you do the time, you could read or perhaps write the great American novel. Sorry, I've already written the great American nonfiction book, which you're listening to right now. This was a time to go out and build a treehouse with your son, or to cook lasagna with your wife and daughter. I interviewed the great Kevin Bacon during the midst of the shutdown, and he said, he did a puzzle with his wife for the first time ever. Again, you're doing the time no matter what. You could come out with a great novel or a venereal disease. During the first week of Shelter in Place, I was hiking with my son and seeing all the people getting some fresh air and realized that this was a sort of forced Sabbath for atheists. When you have a religion, there are specific days and sometimes weeks and sometimes even full months where you have to not use electricity, not eat meat, go to your house of worship, and spend time with family. The thing you're not doing is hauling your ass to Cleveland to do stand-up. For an atheist like myself, every day is a potential work day. But this forced everything to slow down, and it felt good. If there's a positive yin to the pandemic yang, this is it. Not only that, but for a few sweet, blissful days, while everyone was hunkering down, L.A. became an Omega Man-style ghost town where there was no traffic. This was utopia for me as I headed to do my last set at the Laugh Factory before everyone closed up shop. To my earlier point about fear, the real pandemic is people, mostly white people, panicking. That spread further and wider, much faster than the virus ever did. This was hysteria in the truest sense of the word. I talked many times in this book about how we fell into chick think. I was delighted when Dr. Drew informed me that hysteria comes from the same root word as hysterectomy. Hyster is Greek for uterus. We all literally became chicks. Coronavirus is to the flu as school shootings are to shootings in the inner city. We're familiar with the flu. We have the knowledge that it's not likely to kill you unless you're old or infirm, and we've been hearing about it for a while. Same with inner-city shootings. We've been hearing about them since the 1970s and got immune to it when, by pure numbers, many more die in gang-related violence in Chicago in 1 week than die in school shootings in a year. This pandemic exposed a major flaw in our society that I've long complained about. We literally can't do the math. All of our problems, many of which I laid out in this book, are fueled by feelings rather than facts. We have data that we are ignoring. The news is complicit in this. It's their job to scare the crap out of you. In this case, they literally scared the crap out of people enough that there was a run on toilet paper. People were getting into fistfights over Charmin. The paper goods section at the supermarket turned into the Jerry Springer show. What happened to dignity? You're choking a bitch over some two-ply? You're supposed to be dueling with pistols at dawn when someone offends your honor, not duking it out in aisle 11 at Stop and Shop. We have laws against gouging. If a hurricane comes through, I'm not allowed to go to Home Depot, load up 100 sheets of plywood at $34 a pop, and then charge you $150. But we have no rules around hoarding. Dr. Drew's wife is the whitest, least methiest-looking woman on the planet. She tried to buy 2 boxes of Sudafed and was stopped in her tracks. As if the middle-aged lady from Pasadena was making trucker speed in her bathtub. There are rules. There should be some for hoarding. If you try to walk out of a Kroger with 28 packs of Angel Soft, someone should stop you and say, "How many assholes do you have? Are you Mormon? Is this for all the sister wives?" I understand if it was D-cell batteries, ammunition, or cans of beans, but why toilet paper as your apocalypse hoarding item? I guess if all you ate is those beans, you'd need it. I feel like I could go a year without using toilet paper if I needed to. It would be rough, but I could do it. I'd start with spent tube socks and eventually work my way to my dog's tail. To that end, if we were all still the freaked out, narcissistic dicks and cunts we were at the beginning of this pandemic, by the time you read this and there are still empty toilet paper shelves at the grocery store, you can buy the hardback copy of this book. I put blank pages at the end you can use as TP. If you didn't happen to be one of the asswipes who hoarded all the asswipes.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, Navigating Our All Woke, No Joke Culture, by Adam Carolla, narrated by the author. Additional narration by Mike Dawson. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Orchestra and score provided by Extreme Music. Visit extrememusic.com. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for being a recorded books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.